Hey guys, this is Din.
And this is Rish.
And welcome to a very special edition of Z-Talk, the Zelda Dungeon Podcast.
As most of you know, October 26, 2010 was Majora's Mask 10th anniversary of release in the US.
And Zelda Dungeon has decided to celebrate by deeming November Majora's Mask Month.
Our entire cast is dedicated to this iconic game. Please enjoy. There are many things being done around the Zelda Dungeon website for Majora's Mask Month.
There sure is. In our forums on the Zelda Dungeon site, there was a thread posted by Durion, and it became our featured thread. It was titled, Was Majora's Mask a Step in the Right Direction? The thread's absolutely brilliant commentary from many of our members on our forums, and it actually ended up being posted on the main Zelda Dungeon website by Kyberian.
The Majora's Mask soundtrack has been brought to Zelda Dungeon by Bayside Rules. She posted it all up for us.
It was great work, too. The Green has been hard at work at posting and re-featuring articles that have been published on several different Zelda community sites. He re-featured these articles and are available for our enjoyment once again. As well, we have many new articles about Majora's Mask being set out. February Eve just posted a very recent one about the different masks in Majora's Mask, which we all know is the basis of the game. And so you should run over and take a look at those articles. They're a great source of entertainment and discussion topics.
Definitely. Now, I know a lot of you guys watch Axel the Beast's Curiosity Shops and eagerly await them. I know that this month, all of them are dedicated to Majora's Mask questions.
Well, that's sure exciting.
That definitely is.
I gotta get my questions in. I always forget to send in my questions.
I mean to get them in and then I get busy.
So make sure you send Axel some questions, but make sure they're Majora's Mask questions. He's only taking them this month so that we can celebrate the anniversary of the game.
For sure. Zinnamon has some fan art up.
Yeah, she's been collecting fan art from a whole bunch of different forum members and showcasing them.
Definitely.
And Bayside Rules has also been hosting the graphics community competition, and this week she had Majora's Mask Wallpapers was the competition submissions. And we have a winner!
Congratulations to
Fierce Deity!
Great job, Fierce Deity. I really enjoyed yours.
It was beautiful, wasn't it?
Definitely, it was a good one.
So, for Majora's Mask Month, we were asking for submissions from forum members and you folks that listen to our podcast and read up on the Zelda Dungeon site. And we had some great submissions for Majora's Mask Month and for theories on Majora's Mask and aspects of the game.
Definitely. Din, why does it say here some random person sent us something?
Yeah, we got
Who's
this...
Who's that?
I don't know. We got a submission from some totally random person. He has a theory about the Red Star in Majora's Mask?
The one that's only visible on the first day.
At night, yeah.
Okay, so let's head into that and see what this random person has to say about it.
Sup, CD?
Random person here. Now, I know what you're thinking. Random person, he's always talking about keeping his privacy. What's he doing on the podcast? Well, you can call me a hypocrite if you want, but as much as I love talking about keeping my privacy, I love talking about Zelda even more, and this is a good way to expand on it. You know, I love Zelda. It's one of the reasons that brought me to Zelda Dungeon. But anyway, that's enough about the random person. You already know enough about me. If you don't know enough about me, that's too bad for you, because I'm not here to talk about me. I'm here to talk about Zelda. And what I will be talking about on Zelda is a game that's pretty much my favorite, and if you don't know that's my favorite, then you're pretty noobish. No, I'm just playing. Majora's Mask. And what I will be talking about on Majora's Mask is the red star that appears in the sky. And nobody really seems to know what it is. But I have a theory, and I'm going to explain it to you. But first, before I get to that, what am I talking about? For those of you who've never played Majora's Mask or never noticed the red star. In Majora's Mask, there are days and nights, 3 days, three nights. On your first night, if you look up in the sky, I guarantee you cannot miss it. If you look up, the first thing you will see is that giant moon. And then you will see the red star. The red star sticks out among the others. I believe it's a little bit brighter than the rest. Most of the stars are white. They have some light blue, some darker blue, but the red star sticks out. And when you first see it, you're thinking, that red star sticks out. I wonder what it is. There's a giant moon there, so I'm kind of not going to worry about it right now. I need to save Termina. But then, as you rewind time, you see it again, and again, and again, and again, and again. And you begin wondering, what in the wig is that red star? Was it put there randomly, or what? I don't get it. You know, some people, a lot of people have pretty much their different conclusions as to what it is. Some people think it's just a red star in the distance. Some people think that it's Mars. Some people think that it's a glitch in the game. Nobody really thinks it's a glitch in the game. It's just, when you're comparing things like that, it's better to have three things, and I only had two, so. But anyway, I have a theory as to what exactly the red star is. I have an experiment as to what exactly the red star is. And I have a conclusion as to, wait for it, exactly what the red star is. Okay. The experiment goes like this. I'll explain it to you so you can go through it. And I go through it. I've done it many times. And I get the exact same results every single time. So if you get a different result, don't blame me. You can blame your console. You can blame my console. But don't blame me because my console gives me the same result anytime. Okay. Experiment goes like this. Go to Romani's ranch and help her out with her them problem. You know, you don't really even have to win this. The whole point of doing this is to find out the exact time that the them problem starts. You want the exact time. You can use the bomber's notebook, but I wouldn't, because the bomber's notebook doesn't constantly move. You have to keep pressing pause and looking at it. And, you know, when you pause, you're pausing time momentarily. So, but you want to find out on this sundial or whatever that thing is on the screen when this event starts. Now, excuse me. I tried a thought there for a second. Find out this exact time. Go and rewind time. Go back to the first night. Now, you probably want to find something to entertain yourself until about midnight, because you don't want Link just standing there, you know, pulling up his man skirt all bored. Okay, but when it gets around the time that you're supposed to be helping Romani's ranch, or supposed to be helping Romani, make sure you look up in the sky. You can do this pretty much anywhere. I've done it in many locations, and I've come out with, as I said, the same result. The only place I've no 100% sure I've never tried is Romani's Ranch, because whenever I'm there, I'm protecting her from them, so I don't have time to look up in the sky. But go somewhere and look up in the sky around the before they come down, and try not to think about Romani, because she's about to get kidnapped right now because you're not there to help her. But stare at the red star at the exact time that you're supposed to save Romani, that the event starts. The red star just, it disappears. First time, I couldn't believe it, that it actually happened. But the red star, it just disappears. And you're wondering, where in the wig did it go? What? And my conclusion to this is that the red star is actually the light that comes down on Romani's ranch, because the red star disappears on the first night at the exact time that you're supposed to be helping Romani, and it is never seen again until you rewind time. So, I'm guessing that the red star is either them coming toward Termina, or them orbiting Termina, you know, just waiting to strike. But I'm pretty sure the red light is them, you know. Now, you could argue saying that this is just a coincidence, but I mean, come on. You know, the people just chose a random time to make the star disappear. Okay, I'm not an expert on randomness, but, you know, I'm pretty high up there, and I don't think so. That was a very corny joke. but, like I said, try this experiment, you know, or you don't have to. You can just believe me because, you know, I'm so truthful. no, don't do that. I'm just some random person. but you can try this experiment on your own, and I'm pretty sure you will get the same results I get, and I'm pretty sure you will most likely agree with me. But if you don't, you know, I'm an understanding random person. You know, there are lots of theories out there. You know, I have a lot of my own, and you can do whatever. But that's pretty much my thesis experiment conclusion on what the red star is. And thanks for listening. Random person out.
Random person has a voice?
That's awesome!
So, you heard it here first, folks. It's confirmed. Random person is a guy. Or at least has a guy's voice.
Rish.
Alright, fine. let's move on.
He's got a good theory.
He does have a good theory. Let's move on.
Okay. So Majora's Mask. Well, what's it really known for?
It's known for its masks.
Well, yeah.
Obviously, but specifically, its transformation masks.
Yeah, for sure. We get three throughout the game. Three main transformation masks.
Yeah, there's always the fourth.
And we talk about the fourth, of course.
Of course.
Well, let's start with number one. The Deku Mask, or Dooku Mask, or however you want to pronounce that word.
Definitely one of the ones I didn't enjoy quite as much as the other ones.
No, I think we all get psychological damage from that mask for being trapped for three whole days in that form and not being able to do anything you're
as
used
a
to
shrub.
Be
shrub.
You're not used to that at
no.
all. You're used to being Link and being epic, and then you're trapped in this body that you're not.
And you're a little shrub that can run around and, like, spit bubbles at things. That's about it.
You can fly. Well, glide.
You can
glide.
It's not flying. It's gliding. Even Tingle can fly. But you can't.
Tingle has a balloon.
You know what? That's still better than what you have as...
I do not agree at all. You can steer with those flower copters.
You know what? I'm sure he could steer, too. He just doesn't choose to.
Well... I think Deku Link was one of the easier to control transformation forms. The spin was very easy to travel fast and control at the same time, whereas Mask Number 2 was not.
Oh, the almighty Goron Mask. Remember, nothing's quite as strong as stone, unless you run headlong into it when you're rolling. Then it seems to be that you're as strong as stone.
But the Goron Mask had its disadvantages. I mean, water was not fun. The Gorons, we learned in Majora's Mask, are susceptible to water. And I personally, every single time, jumped off the cliff from the hot spring and landed in the pool rather than landing on the beach. Or I guess it wasn't a beach, but on the ledge. And was reset several times.
Also known as bad control schemes.
Well, the bad control scheme was simply the
lack of control? Well,
difficulty in steering. You got rolling, and you got spikes, and now you're all cool and dangerous, and you can't control where you're going.
It's like strapping a jetpack onto your back and trying to turn very sharply around a corner. Not very good for anyone.
Doesn't work so well. And then, on the moon, you get to do 90-degree turns as a Goron. Now that's fun. I'm not kidding. That minigame, there was like hours devoted to that game.
Oh, it
took forever.
I don't know why you would waste your time on that. But you know what? Let's talk about the third mask, one that had a very smooth control scheme.
The Zora mask was one of the best transformation masks. And you know what? It was also a fan favorite, or a player's favorite.
I felt definitely I was pretty happy when I got to pretty much be an underwater ninja.
He was an online ninja too. He didn't quite move. Zora Link didn't move very fast on the land, but his like ninja kicks and the boomerang fins.
I mean, it was pretty cool, but it makes sense that a fish person wouldn't work very well on land.
But the magic barrier in the water. That was cool.
That was very cool.
And personally, I like the dolphin dives.
Definitely, as a swimmer, I enjoyed them too. You know what, though? I really, really, really want to talk about the next mask. Can we? Please?
Well, of course we can, but most people don't consider it to be one of the main transformation masks.
But it's a transformation mask, so we get to talk about it, right, Din?
Yes.
Yes, we do.
Just for you.
I gotta say, I love, love, love the Fierce Deity mask. Only one big problem.
Boss rooms only!
Unless you glitch. And if
glitches!
You guys... No. If you guys remember from our last podcast, I dislike glitching very, very much so. So I never really get to enjoy it outside the boss rooms. Although, as soon as you have it, it makes boss rooms not bosses anymore,
not
I guess.
They're not fun anymore.
No, it's almost too easy.
Well, yes and no, because I distinctly remember going, oh, this will be great. I know what I'll do. I'll go kill all the bosses on day one with the Fierce Deity Mask. But, you know, they're designed to be fought with the mask that they're associated with.
Right.
And I had a lot of trouble fighting Gott with
the Fierce Deity Mask,
because you're supposed to roll after him. No. Yes. Yeah, that is Gott. Yeah. You're supposed to roll after him and jump and hit him with your spikes, and it was standing there as Fierce Deity, you couldn't keep up with him, because Fierce Deity's not as fast as Goron Link.
That's true. You know what, though? When you get to Majora at the very end of the game, it's like, boom, 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 you're done. Game over.
Pretty much.
Which is almost upsetting, in a way.
Which is why you fight him as a Link for your challenge. It's like fighting Ganon from Ocarina of Time with the iron boots on.
Hey, why... yeah, but no.
Anyway, Majora's Mask cast, so...
Definitely. So, you know what?
Which is the best mask?
Oof, that's a tough one. I'll have to go with either... From the main transformation masks, I gotta say the Zora mask.
And you know what? It's a fan favorite, and it is the easiest to control, and he does the most.
There's a reason it's a fan favorite.
That's true.
So definitely, from Din and Rish, we gotta say the Zora mask is the number one.
Unless you wanna say coolness factor, and then, you know.
And then you gotta go Fierce Deity. Just cause.
Takes the cake.
For sure. Alright, so you guys will remember from our last podcast that Axel the Beast periodically takes breaks from the Curiosity Shop in order to bring us roundtable discussions. And this time around, he's brought us a roundtable discussion based on Majora's Mask,
of course.
Comparing it to...
The rest of the series, the rest of the Zelda series.
So we hope you enjoy it, and take it away, Axel.
Alright, so the topic for today is Majora's Mask, specifically how it compares to the rest of the series. And we have two guests for this time. The first guest is Tim, or Hanyu. He's one of our forum moderators and a site staff member. What's up, Tim?
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's not what's up. And then we have Joe, or Bayside Rules, who is a site staff member. What's up, Joe?
Oh, not much. You?
Not much. Alright, so, first of all, I guess we should start with something that everyone always brings up when talking about Majora's Mask, so it's very ripe for comparison to the rest of the series. The tone of Majora's Mask, and, like, people always talk about how dark the game is. Tim, why don't you start? Do you feel that Majora's Mask is dark?
Yeah, I think it definitely has a unique tone compared to, say, Ocarina of Time. It's claustrophobic, definitely. But I never felt as though the threat were really as grand as it was in other Zelda games. For example, in Ocarina of Time, you see the results of Ganon's, you know, what they're basically, when Ganon wreaks havoc on Hyrule, you see what happens. And it's there to stay. When people die, it's permanent, etc. A Link to the Past, you see the effects of the Dark World. I just didn't get that from Majora's Mask, mainly because while a lot of stuff happens in 3 days, you get to start over every 3 days. So none of the impact really feels permanent.
I find that interesting because I, on the other hand, found Majora's Mask to be a very dark game. I felt that you had 3 days to get a ton of stuff done, and if you didn't, people's lives were affected. I felt really a personal connection to the townspeople, and that if I didn't save them, that in 3 days that moon was going to fall and they were going to die and there was no more. So I really felt that the tone of the story was really, really dark, and it kind of gave the game a sense of urgency.
Well, I think that the tone was like that in, like, the beginning of the game, especially during, like, the introduction where you were actually learning about the moon falling. But I felt that other than a couple of isolated cases, after you, like, got into the meat of the game, the story didn't, like, make a big point of the moon falling. You barely even would look up and see the moon. It was just like, felt like a standard Zelda game at that point. And I also felt like by the end, unlike a lot of other Zelda games, things really, like, even out by the end, and it had a really good ending.
I would agree. One thing to take into account is that most Zelda games really do have kind of bittersweet endings. And Majora's Mask had a mostly positive ending. So I think that kind of kept the tone from being as dark as it otherwise could have been.
That's interesting. Yeah, because it definitely is a different perspective for me to look at, because I just felt like overall the game was very dark, but as you mentioned, the ending is really positive, and so I guess that does lighten the mood a bit. So I really felt that we had a personal connection to the townspeople in this game. It wasn't like Ocarina of Time, where when you were running around the city that you just heard little bits and bits, pieces of gossip. These people had real lives, real cares, real worries. Like, Andrew and Cafe were getting married, and, like, you had that connection of the two lovers and their love for each other. In Romani's Ranch, you know, they referenced their friends in Clock Town, and they're all friends. While it wasn't essential to the storyline, it gave you a connection that these people were personal and friendly with each other. And I found that the focus on the side material and in this game was very unique, and I felt like it gave a new layer to the game because it was much more adventurous.
Are you saying that was actually a darker aspect of the game? Because that just sort of seems like it makes the game deeper. I can see how there would be points where that would add darkness to the game, but is that what you meant to say?
Well, yeah, I think deeper and darker. In some ways, it was darker, like for me, knowing that their lives were going to end if I didn't do something about it. But on the other hand, it did give the game depth. It gave you a reason to play the game. It gave you a reason to save Hyrule because you started to care and interact with these people.
If you look at the side quests in context of the main quest, I think there's definitely something there to say, you know, when you get involved with these characters, when you're required almost to you know, learn the minutiae of their daily lives, their schedules, the prospect of a moon dropping on Clock Town takes on an added weight. I don't really doubt that. It's just that the structure kind of kept me from feeling as though the threat was permanent. But definitely the side quest focus helped helped to flesh out the story of the game. You know, it kind of permeated everything. So, I kind of liked that aspect.
Would that really make it so much... I keep going back to this, I guess, but I don't know if that necessarily makes it more darker than games like the Wind Waker, where you have... I don't know, there was a lot of moments in the Wind Waker where you learned a lot about the characters' individual stories. It wasn't side quest focused like Majora's Mask. It had a lot more of the linear storytelling, but there was a lot of moments where you actually got a little more insight into the characters' lives, and I felt they had some sad moments that added to the darkness of that game. And the character development was pretty heavy in the Wind Waker, and I don't know, what do you think, Joe?
Well, I would say that it had Wind Waker not been a cel-shaded game, it would have been very, very dark. I felt like that they made it a much lighter game because of their use of the animations. But yeah, the characters very much did have dark lives, and you did find out some pretty dark secrets about them. And I think, yeah, that game was dark. Does it make it as if they're copying Majora's Mask? I don't think so. Does it add depth to that story as well? I think so.
Well, you know, just on the subject of darkness, I think darkness is overrated, and it's people look for dark elements in Zelda games. There's certainly dark elements in Zelda. There's some dark elements in Mario. They're substantial in Zelda. They're much more substantial. But as far as Majora's Mask is concerned, I think the depth is what's important. And that's why people keep going back to the game. That's why people like it. That's what singles it out. And the side quest focus is definitely an important part of that depth, as is the 3-day cycle, which keeps it unique. The fact that you can learn about the world in detail because you can keep going over the same events from different perspectives, almost like that Akira Kurosawa movie, Rashomon. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it correctly.
You probably aren't.
Rashomon, I think. You get to see you get to see the world from all these different angles. So Majora's Mask, darkness or not, is really about detail, and that's its unique flair.
Is that something you think that no other game in the series has quite came to, that level of detail?
Yeah, I think games subsequent games in the series, like The Wind Waker, and Spirit Tracks even, without the 3-day cycle, have managed to emulate a level of detail, kind of by building off of the Wind Waker, building off of the side quest focus. But I think up to that point, no game had really reached that level of detail. And Ocarina of Time is my personal favorite, but I still don't think it had some of those qualities that Majora's Mask did.
I'd have to say I really agree with Tim here. I think that the level of deepness was really I feel like it was something that was very special to Majora's Mask. I loved playing the game, and I loved the fact that it was more adventurous because you had these side quests that were related to the main game. And I think that getting to know and seeing it from different perspectives really helped you understand the people and get involved in the game.
Yeah, it's really the main quest structure that allows for the side quest focus and allows for the side quest not to feel out of place. And like I mentioned before, the claustrophobia of the game, which it might be a wrong term, that's a little dramatic, but there's certainly an intimacy to the game that you don't get in grand epic adventures like A Link to the Past or Ocarina. And, again, the 3-day cycle, it's a vital gameplay element, it's a vital story element. It really ties everything together. And I know it's taken a lot of criticism from people, more than it deserved, because not only does it give Majora's Mask its unique strength, without it I don't think we would have the level of detail in the side quest or the main quest, but also because it's a quality mechanic, much like I feel sailing is in the Wind Waker that people also criticize. So, you know, I love the 3-day cycle, just for those different angles it gives you.
Yeah, see, I on the other hand felt like the 3-day cycle, it made me feel rushed, throughout the game, and as a casual gamer, I couldn't just pick up and play the game. Like, I couldn't just pick up and play a half hour, because when I ended my game for the day, I'd either have to warp to an owl statue, or I'd have to start my 3-day cycle over again in order to save. And, you know, that erased your rupees, your arrows, everything. So it was like, in order to pick up the game again from there, you had to go out, you had to do exploring, you had to do the prep work all over again before you could go and tackle your adventure once more. And for me, that was a turnoff to the game. It made me feel like if I didn't have a good solid hour, hour and a half to play, then I really just could not pick up the game and play it.
Let me go ahead and agree with Joe on the saving. But I think one thing people do too often is that they equate the saving with the 3-day cycle. I know they're related, definitely related, but they're not one and the same. They could have used the 3-day cycle without having what I consider the broken save system that asks so much of the player for something as simple as saving. I really dislike that. I think Joe expressed most of my objections to it.
Well, I think they are the same. I think the point is they didn't have to be. They could have made... They're not two mechanics that had to be intertwined, but they were in Majora's Mask. So I think as they were implemented, you can't say that they weren't the same, but they didn't have to be if they made it in a different way.
No, I don't think they were the same. I think they played off of each other. I think the save system was based in the time mechanic. It didn't have to be. And, no, I don't think they're the same. That's a stretch.
Fair enough. Let's talk about the controls. Tim, in conversations I've had with you in the past, you've complained about the controls. Haven't both of you?
Yes, I am very much frustrated with the controls you play as Goron Link. I think the controls as Human Link, Deku Link, and Zora Link were actually fun and interesting to play as. But as a Goron, I felt that when I got up to full speed as a rolling Goron, there was no control there. I remember getting frustrated, falling off the cliff time after time after time, and it really did not make the game more interesting for me to play. I actually got frustrated and quit quite a few times because I could not control my character. And to me, that's a gaming flaw and not always on the player themselves.
Right. I totally agree. You know, games should be difficult sometimes, often. I think Contra is an example where it's down to the gamer's skill. In Majora's Mask, controlling the Goron was an absolute mess. This is something that comes with 3D. It's something companies have to work around. But I think there was basically little regard for the input of the gamer when they were designing the Goron. One example is the Goron racetrack. I have always felt winning the Goron races is a matter of luck. Turning corners as a Goron is a matter of luck. I don't know where the camera is going to take me. I don't know if I'm going to hit that wall. I really shouldn't be questioning that when I'm playing the game. I should be firm in the knowledge that if I input the proper controls and I do it with the right level of skill, I'll get the right response. To an extent, I also had that with Zora Link in one or two locations where I had to jump over the water, but rarely. I think the Zora controlled beautifully. So did everything else in the game. It's just Goron Link.
I think you guys are crazy because I've never had any trouble whatsoever with the Goron. I've probably had more trouble with the Zora than the Goron.
Did you have any trouble in the Goron races?
The Goron races, I will give you that, they suck. And they, until recently, they were complete luck element. But I think once I practiced enough recently, I just don't have any trouble with that anymore either.
Perhaps Tim and I should go practice some more then.
Hmm.
Play some NES.
After 10 years, I don't think I'm getting it. I think another example of failure on the part of the Goron is the Snowhead Temple, where you have to climb all the way back up when you fall. And in large part, this is due to the Goron itself, but it's also due to the design of that temple and all of the temples in the game, where there's kind of a lack of a central hub like there was in Link's Awakening, which I think was a great development in that game, where you would have warps to other areas of the dungeon from the front. And in Ocarina of Time, dungeons were almost circular most of the time, even the water temple. In Majora's Mask, I think they might have tried to do that, but if you go to the Stone Tower Temple, you have to redo basic tasks. I must have wasted at least 30 minutes putting those Elegy of Emptiness statues on the switches. I just felt like the dungeons were wasting my time, especially when I wanted to get Stray Fairies, which I really did want to do. And it's another example of, I think, frustrating design on the part of the game developers. Something they could have streamlined like they did in other Zelda games, but they chose not to, along with the saving and the Goron.
I kind of felt similar frustrations in some of the dungeons. My hardest temple that I played was Snowhead's Temple, and it took me a good 3 hours to complete, mainly because I played, I turned off the game, and came back to it, and I had no idea what I was doing. And I got lost, and when I reset my 3-day cycle, everything had undone itself. So as a gamer, I was confused because I did not know where I needed to be or what I was doing. And, you know, once I figured it out, it was actually a pretty simple dungeon, but I felt like they could have designed it better.
I don't know. I actually thought that the Majora's Mask dungeons were some of the best in the series, mainly because they just were so, mind-bending and challenging. I guess I can see elements where you could say they were badly designed. I think, like Tim was saying, having to redo parts of the dungeons, especially when looking for the Stray Fairies, perhaps that's something where they could have improved it with kind of like the stuff they had in Link's Awakening or Minish Cap, where the puzzles in the dungeon, them being solved is saved as you go through the dungeon. So if you go back through an area, the puzzle is completed. But I didn't think it was a problem that there was no central like hub of the dungeon or whatever. I actually think that's an idea that's interesting for a dungeon sometimes, but I don't like it when they do that all the time because I think it makes it feel like every dungeon is the same kind of like lobby area, like a hotel or something, and then you're just going up to another floor from the lobby trying to access new rooms. I like it more when it feels like you're delving deeper into a dungeon. Like, I think I felt like the Forest Temple in Ocarina of Time was designed a lot like that, although it did have the central area too, I suppose. Ironically, Stone Tower Temple is probably my favorite dungeon in the series, though I will admit, Snowhead Temple kind of sucks.
Another thing to take into account about Ocarina of Time is you had Furori's Wind, which I didn't use the first few times I've played it, but I've since learned it is pretty useful. But I think a lot of what I'm saying, and I won't speak for Joe, but I think some of what she's saying will probably sound to people who like Majora's Mask like nitpicking. But when you combine all of it and put it together with the time element, which I think is great, but, you know, combined with everything else, it turns from nitpicking into major game design annoyances, which hinder the experience of an otherwise great game for me.
Now that you mentioned Feyore's Wind, I think that would have been a great element to have added into Majora's Mask, because that would have saved me a lot of time when I have to go roam the fields to gather supplies, and then I could just warp back into the castle or dungeon.
Definitely.
Well, you could use the Song of Soaring to warp back to the beginning of the dungeon, but being able to warp into the dungeon would have been pretty sweet. I suppose that's a very good point. Okay, well, any final thoughts, Joe?
Well, I know I've sounded really overall negative about the game, but I really do like Majora's Mask. I love that it's an adventurous game. I do think it has some flaws, but, I mean, it won't stop me from playing the game yet again and beating it again. I think it's a great adventure, and if you have not yet played it, I think you should try it.
How about you, Tim?
I agree with that. Majora's Mask is hailed as one of the best games in the franchise. I doubt that, but I do enjoy it very much. And I think it's definitely, it should be praised for its unique qualities. Overall, the experience is great. There are just a few things that keep it from being on the level of the greatest Zelda games for me.
As for me, well, most of you probably know that Majora's Mask is my favorite game in the series, and it's also probably one of the few ones I would cite as being perfect or near perfect, so I come from a very biased point of view. Needless to say, if you're a Zelda fan, I think you owe it to yourself to get Majora's Mask, and I think it had a lot of good ideas that the rest of the series could learn from, or at least keep in mind when this is being designed. Alright, so thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
See you guys later.
Bye.
See you.
Thank you, Axel, Joe, and Tim, for that roundtable discussion.
You know, I don't get it. I'm sorry, I just don't.
What don't you get?
The time cycle. I don't understand. I don't understand why the time cycle was a problem.
You know what? 3 days wasn't long enough. Give me a week. Come on, give me 7 days. Saving the world...
takes more than 3 days?
Takes a lot of time, okay?
But you could go back in time. You could do it as many times as you want. You could have as many days as you want, as long as it was a multiple of three.
As long as it was multiple of three and you didn't mind redoing everything every
you
time.
You didn't. That was the thing, though, is there was save points in the game. You just had to know when to reset time.
When to reset time, where to find those save points.
But it became obvious as you played through the game. Every time you found an owl statue... you open the statue, play the song, and go back to that owl statue, and then you're in exactly the same place that you were at the beginning of day one. Bada bing, bada boom.
You know what? I didn't find it quite as easy as Din here did. I still gotta say, you needed more than 3 days to save the world. Come on now.
I guess losing your items probably was the part that I didn't like the most.
I was pretty choked about losing my items.
But you could save your rupees if you went to the bank.
Yes, which I made sure to do every time I could, but still.
Yeah, I forgot about it a lot and lost all my rupees.
Definitely. And you know what? Like, I do like the idea of the time cycle. I just felt that it could have been implemented better.
Okay.
Could have been implemented better. Maybe... you retained
your arrows and your bombs.
Arrows and everything, because you go back in time with those things.
You did retain your major items, which obviously you'd have to, because if you couldn't, then it would be a bit of an issue.
Yes, but that's the thing. If you can retain your major items, why couldn't you carry arrows back in time? What makes arrows not able to come back, or bombs, or anything like that? You're just not allowed. You can have your sword, but you can't have anything else.
Well, if they took your sword away, I don't think that would be very... it'd be hard for Link to save the world without his sword.
But you know what? Other than the answer of game logic, there's no real answer for that.
That's true.
So we'll have to go with game logic.
Which is the worst answer ever for Zelda theorizers, but that's okay. Once in a while, you have to use it.
You know what? It'd be really hard to defeat Majora without your items. And you know what? Majora as a villain is a very big topic.
Yeah, and you know, some people don't believe he really is the villain that people say he is. And we have one person that has made a submission, a brilliant submission, theorizing this, that Majora... as the villain in the game, really isn't a villain as we perceive villains. So, we're going to send it over to Duck Noises and hear from him.
Take it away.
And of course, as always, please note that the following contains spoilers.
Hi, this is Duck Noises here, and I'm going to talk a little bit about... the character of Majora. So, something that always struck me as odd is how people intend to interpret Majora as an evil character, and that Majora is, like, the pinnacle of evil. To be honest, but I never really interpreted Skull Kid nor Majora as manifestations of evil, but really manifestations of chaos. Skull Kid is just your run-of-the-mill, misunderstood, possessed child. Happens every day. I'd hardly consider Skull Kid evil, but Majora doesn't really have a sinister goal or desire, which is almost a prerequisite of every archetypal villain ever. However, you could argue that this makes Majora special, but I wouldn't say it makes Majora more evil, necessarily. If you look at your classical villains, let's take Ganondorf, just because we can. He's kind of like Cassius from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. But Majora, Well, Ganondorf has an end to his malicious actions. He wants power. Whereas Majora seems to have none. He doesn't have a goal. We never hear much at all about Majora, really. We just hear the occasional rambling about destruction, and Majora's goals are never really defined. I think this is what... That it's Majora's lack of intentions that make him, her, or it not as evil as most villains. The way in one achieves their goals is what determines them to be ethically good or evil. By achieving your goal through righteous methods, you are good. Conversely, if you achieve your goals through wrong methods, you are evil. Majora has no goals nor plan as such, and I don't think we can properly evaluate Majora as a villain. A lot of the things learned about the antagonist in Majora's Mask are more about Skull Kid than Majora, and I think that was the proper way to go with the game. Skull Kid represented the misunderstood, lonely child reaching out at a desperate plea for attention, whose voice ultimately became corrupted by the voice of chaos. I don't really perceive Majora as an individual, but rather a physical manifestation of chaos, whose physical form was only really needed for the final boss battle. I see Majora's primary role as a symbolic one, that occasional lapse in judgment where we let our reason slip and let our periodic frustration seize control. To me, that's what Majora is. That's where we have to make the distinction between different kinds of villainy. We have to make the distinction between amoral and immoral. Amoral is lacking the very understanding of morality, the lack of comprehension for what it means to be good or to be bad. Majora is malicious because Majora finds pleasure in it. Were Majora able to comprehend the gravity of their actions or understand people's reactions, they might consider stopping. Now, it's the lack of this emotional recognition that makes Majora an amoral character, or even a symbol, and I hesitate to view Majora as an entity of evil, as some people do. So let's take Ganondorf. On the other hand, he's immoral. He knows what he's doing, and he knows that it's wrong. He understands the gravity and the effect of his actions, and he continues to do evil despite being persuaded to stop. He's a reprobate, really, and that word can refer to both immoral and amoral, but in this case I'm referring to immoral. He acknowledges the suffering of others, yet he doesn't do anything to stop it because it doesn't help him in any way. Ganondorf, in addition to being immoral, is also pragmatic, which results in him being duplicitous, which I think augments his level of evil in a more traditional way. I'm going to go back to Cassius here and say, use that. It's quite fitting that he's both pragmatic and immoral, which are very standard qualities of a dictator, as he is. It comes down to what you think is more evil. One who is duplicitous and cognizant of their evil, utilizing deceit, treachery, and cruelty to meet their goals, or one who doesn't understand the notions of cruelty and mercy, guilt, and innocence, and will continue to act in their lack of judgment akin to the emotional level of a small child, which is like Majora. Now, I think of amorality as more of a tragic flaw. Now, let's note a dictionary's distinction between the terms evil, amoral, and immoral. It says evil is an adjective. It is morally wrong or bad, immoral, and or due to actual or imputed bad conduct or character, e.g. an evil reputation. It defines amoral as not involving questions of right or wrong, without moral equality, neither moral nor immoral. Or having no moral standards, restraints, or principles, unaware of or indifferent to questions of right or wrong, a completely amoral person. And immoral is violating moral principles, not conforming to the patterns of conduct usually accepted or established as consistent with principles of personal and social ethics. So the terms defining amoral don't contain as heavy an implication of evil as seen in immoral. This immoral was actually in the definition of evil. Now, the inability to recognize whether or not one is doing wrong is likely the cause of wrongdoings for Majora. Majora merely acts and doesn't act with the intent of right or wrong. Evil is more of a byproduct of Majora's actions, whereas its intent is just the action itself. This is why I intend to interpret Majora as a force of chaos rather than evil. And I think Majora acts as a symbol of chaos because Majora's mask, the object itself, is symbolic of corruption through power, which strives to replace order with disorder. Now, the game Majora's Mask often referred to things in a matter of order or disorder, rather than good and evil. Take Clock Town, for example. Clocks are symbolic of structure and organization and schedules. A Clock Town as a whole is a meticulous automaton, and the events of the game are structured and scheduled with the emphasis of time in mind. However, the game throws structure out of the window, at least in the story, causing Clock Town to act in disarray. The game's narrative takes the form of order versus disorder, hence the final song you play, Oath to Order. The whole metaphor of innocence and amorality is really enforced at the end of the game when you speak to the children on the moon. One of them asks asks, "The right thing, what is it?" And I find that that's a demonstration of a lack of understanding of moral conventions, which is amorality. The Moon Children and Majora are trapped in the surreal world on top of the moon with no recognition of right or wrong. All they want to do is play. They can't interpret the moral status of what or how they play, and whatever they do is for their amusement. They're isolated from reality and therefore from societal conventions, so the notion of morality and its impact is almost entirely absent from their thought. Another one of the Moon Children mentions, "I wonder, if you do the right thing, does it really make everybody happy?" So I think that the absence of right and wrong in the characters is what makes Majora's Mask a dark game. It all takes place in between shades of gray. I believe Majora, the character, follows this pattern, and that's why I think Majora isn't really evil. Majora is amoral. And I think this is something that makes Majora's Mask different from other Zelda games. This shows how morality and order fade away in the face of adversity, being Majora. Rather than focusing on physical moral conflict, like most Zelda games, it focuses on the emotional tempest in the characters that is occasionally forgotten. The emotional struggle is reflected in the people of Termina, whereas Majora and the Moon Children reflect the opposite end of the spectrum, where actions supersede emotions, contrasting the norm. I'm just going to conclude by saying that rather than Majora being an embodiment of evil, I feel that Majora is a symbol of the chaos that ensues from the inability to recognize morality itself. And that's all I'm going to say for today. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Duck Noises. That was very insightful. I've always kind of thought of Majora as being a childlike entity, but I've never thought about it in that much detail.
Definitely more mischievous than evil, per se.
Yeah.
Definitely, since Majora doesn't have those end goals other than...
Other than nothing.
He doesn't
have end goals at all.
So definitely, thanks again, Duck Noises. And we'd like to thank everyone who has submitted today for this podcast.
And we'd like to remind everybody listening that... if you'd like to be a part of Z-Talk, you are more than welcome, and we are definitely looking for submissions. There's a link in the description to an invitation, and have a read over of that, and send in your submissions.
So, listeners, what did you guys think about these Majora's Mask theories?
What do you think about the game in general? You should let us know in the comments below. We want to hear your opinions, too.
Definitely. It's always a joy to hear from you guys, so keep those comments rolling in, keep those emails rolling in.
That's a good point, Rish. We're always taking emails from you guys. We want to hear your Zelda questions and your Zelda dungeon questions, and we will answer them and feature them in upcoming podcasts.
Definitely. So don't forget, you guys, the email for that is dinandrish@gmail.com. Thanks for listening today.
This is Din.
And this is Rish.
And this was Z-Talk, the Majora's Mask Special Edition cast.